From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. No technology has had such an immediate impact as the fax machine. Everyone now simply expects to be able to send and receive faxes. Today, we'll look at faxing in the global village and at the creative ways people are using this technology. Carl Malamud joined us once before on this show to talk about starting a radio station on the Internet. That is, a radio station that only plays on a computer network. This time he's back with his colleague Dr. Marshall Rose. Together they figured out how you can fax documents around the world for only a few cents. I'll also speak with Don Peppers. He is a business consultant who sees that the use of mass marketing through print media, radio, and television is being replaced by marketing to the individual. Given the widespread availability of fax machines, we'll discuss different ways they may be used to market directly to you. Carl Malamud made history this spring when he brought radio to the Internet. Worldwide, 20 million Internet users can now listen to Geek of the Week and this program, Tech Nation, by downloading data files containing digitized audio data. Carl never sits still for long, so I asked him what new use he and his associate Marshall Rose had conjured up for the Internet.
Well, radio went quite well, and in our first season we put about a gigabyte and a half of data onto the network, about 50 hours of programming. That's a whole bunch. And we looked at that and said, you know, this is working. And so I called up my colleague, Dr. Marshall Rose, and said, why don't we start a telephone company? Which is actually not really what we're doing, but it's kind of a fun way to describe it. This is basically a way of treating the Internet as a way of sending faxes. Now, you can't send faxes everywhere in the world, but you can to a lot of places. And what's interesting about this is when you send electronic mail, you send electronic mail to me, I'm carl@radio.com. You can also send electronic mail basically to the phone number of the fax machine you're trying to reach. So you don't have to know about gateways and transit networks or any of that stuff. All you do is you send to the phone number. And you might send some plain old ASCII text, or you might send a fancy graphic image or PostScript code. So you can send multiple fonts and very fancy information and things. And what we're doing is just linking the Internet to all these devices out there called fax machines, and we call them printers, because to us that's what these things are. They're printers. And we're trying to make it so any Internet user can use any printer in the world.
Okay, now there's some people out there going, any Internet user? How many Internet users are there?
Well, at last count, and there are no counts actually, but the estimates are roughly 20 million people in roughly 140 countries, and it's growing roughly 20% a month. That is, by the way, the fastest growing communication system in the history of mankind. Postal systems and telephone systems, none of those grew at nearly the rate that we're experiencing here.
So we're talking 15, 20 million people are heretofore sending these email, electronic mail messages back and forth to each other. And all of a sudden, instead of just email, they can send faxes.
Well, you see, in the ideal world, you'd have email, I'd have email, we'd send email to each other, right? But there's a lot of people that don't. And so what we're doing here is really outreach. We're saying we want to be able to communicate with these people that don't yet have email. Maybe it's some corporate salesman and we want to send them a purchase order. Maybe it's a research official and we want to send in a proposal. And so what we're trying to do is integrate what were two separate ways of communicating. I could send you a fax or I could send you email, but I had to go to a different device to do that. And it seems kind of silly to leave your computer, print out the document, pick up the document, move it over to your fax machine, set up a dedicated long-distance circuit all the way to the final point, insist that that fax machine be ready to receive at that moment in time, and send your document over. There's better ways to do things.
Okay, how does it work?
Well, essentially you, the user, send mail to an electronic mail address.
So if
it happens
to
be the fax number that you're trying to reach.
Okay, now I'm sitting there. I've edited a memo, and I want to fax that to you. I log on to the Internet through my computer, and I say, okay, here's where this fax number is.
You would basically address it to remote printer. It's a little more complicated than this, but remote printer at, then you take the phone number, and you flip it around, which sounds weird, but that's just one of those things we do to make your life interesting. And then we add a domain name at the end, tpc.int. I'm Carl at Malama.com, or there's somebody at Sun.com. These are all domains. Those are the way we name people on the Internet. Well, we've just named your fax machine, phonenumber.tpc.int.
What we have now is two sets of listeners out there. There's the set of listeners out there who are already on the Internet, and they're going, I get that, I get that. And then there's a whole lot of people out there who aren't on the Internet. So you got to kind of tag along with this here and understand that there are 15, 20 million people out here who get this. So,
I say, wow, that's easy.
somebody gets this. Basically, you don't start with, I want to send a fax, let me find the Internet. You got to already be an Internet user. You got to understand all of that, how to get around, how to send messages around. And then you sit there and you say, okay, I want to send this out, and you can get out there. Do you need any special hardware or software for this?
This is built right on top of the existing electronic mail system. If you use MCI mail for your mail, you're not directly on the Internet, you use MCI mail or CompuServe, you can use our service. It's whatever the cost you to do electronic mail is what it will now cost you to do a fax, okay? Now, the nice thing about electronic mail is it's distance insensitive, okay? So if you're on the Internet, it costs you a fraction of a penny, literally, to send an electronic mail message. If you're on one of these commercial services like CompuServe or MCI mail, it might cost you 10 or 15 cents. But for that 10 or 15 cents, assuming we have coverage in your area, and we do in many places, like all of Australia, for example, for the cost of that email message, you've now sent a fax.
When I'm on the Internet and I'm sending an email message to somebody, it costs the same whether I send it two blocks away or I send it halfway around the world?
That's right. The Internet is distance insensitive.
So that right now, when I'm faxing something, it's a local phone call if I'm faxing it two blocks away, and it's a long-distance phone call if I'm faxing it to, say, Italy.
And that might cost you more.
Now, Marshall, what part did you have in all this?
Well, my interest is primarily the Internet infrastructure and how you can build new services on top of it. And as Carl has discussed, you know, one of the things which the Internet gives you is the ability to have a uniform addressing scheme to send messages to people, whether they're next across the street, down the hall, or across the world. And so the interesting part was figuring out how we could integrate, say, the special purpose networks we have today for facsimile, for example, and have those somehow mesh with the Internet.
What did you do exactly?
Exactly.
You don't want to hear exactly.
Oh, I do.
Well, it turns out that integrating facsimile and email was very, very simple in the Internet environment. It turns out that there's been, for the last 5 years, a trend in the industry towards developing these things called fax modems, which are basically things you can plug into your PC or your workstation, which will take a file from the computer and image them out over a phone line. And so all we had to do, basically, was provide the infrastructure in the Internet so that when someone said, I need to send a fax to this phone number, it says, oh, go to that Internet host. So basically, we kind of provide a listing or a mapping service between the telephony space and the Internet domain or host space, and that's what's called tpc.int, which is basically the mapping function we installed in the Internet.
Now, a lot of the information that I've seen keeps referring to tpc.int. What does that mean?
Well, tpc.int refers to one part of the Internet naming space. Just to make life difficult for people, we name things from right to left. So the first thing you look at is this .int, which stands for international organizations. Since the telephone system is international, we felt that the mapping function should be in that part. TPC is basically an in-joke in the Internet. It's from a cult film termed The President's Analyst, with James Coburn, Paramount Pictures, I think, 1967, and TPC stands for The Phone Company.
I see. I remember that movie. I think he was sitting there shaking his head saying, let me get this straight. The president is an actor. This is prior to Ronald Reagan. Other than that.
A very prophetic movie.
Very prophetic movie. This all looks like faxes. We're not talking about something that looks funny, right?
No, it's a fax. It's got a cover page. It says, send it tomorrow, immediately. This is urgent. It's got one thing that's a little bit different, which is on the bottom third of your cover page, there might be an advertisement. This fax brought to you by so-and-so. And the reason for that is very simple. There is one cost that is not covered in this scheme. Okay, you're the electronic mail user. You just paid for the cost of your electronic mail. Someone has to place a local phone call on your behalf once it reaches the destination city. And the question is, why should I spend 6 cents when you want to send a fax to Marshall? I don't know either of you guys. Now, you might do it for the following reason. Let's say Marshall works at NASA Ames. He's a rocket scientist. He's not, but if he were, he'd be at NASA Ames.
He looks like a rocket scientist.
He looks like a rocket scientist. And if that were the case, and I'm NASA, I might say, I'm willing to deliver faxes to the following phone numbers, which include Marshall's fax machine. And that would make sense. Okay, well, they would spend 6 cents to get Marshall a fax. Why should I deliver a fax to a total stranger, though? And so we have several models of operation, and one is the community library. They do it because it's a good thing to do. That's NASA. The other is the community newspaper. And in the community newspaper model, you pay for this service by charging an advertiser. And there is, in fact, a group going into the business as we speak called UUNet Technologies. They've sold advertising successfully to three different advertisers, and they're beginning to serve the Washington, D.C. area.
So here I am. I want to send a fax to somebody in Washington, and I don't want to make that long-distance call. So I email it out over the Internet. It gets to this print facility in Washington, and they say, automatically, we will dial up that fax number you want, and we'll send it out. And a third of the page, the cover page, Carl and Marshall's Pizza Parlor loves you and wants your business.
Absolutely.
And that would appear.
Now, there's some rules that are in this, in the defining documents. And there's rules, for example, that the bottom third of the page must have the words paid advertisement, if it in fact is a paid advertisement. You cannot sell mailing lists. Okay, so if you're the remote printer operator and you've been sending all these faxes in, you can't send Carl and Marshall's Pizza Parlor a list of phone numbers and say, you know, we sent this ad to the following places. You can give high-level demographics. You can say, we sent 30 faxes into the following local exchanges. But you can't do marketing. Privacy is very strictly controlled in this scheme. But ultimately, what we're trying to see is a world in which a service, and this particular service is fax, doesn't necessarily have to be carried out by one large corporation. We think the information economy of the future can be a lot of corner mom-and-pop digital delis. We would like to see the kid out of high school or the immigrant coming to the U.S. or some other country saying, here is a business opportunity. And maybe delivering faxes is one of the things that operation does, but they would do many other things. But this is just one example of an operation you can do in a decentralized fashion. And the lesson from this is not necessarily that this is the way you'll do faxes in the future. The lesson is, as our policymakers begin examining the information economy, there are options available. And one of the options is a decentralized, dynamic economy with small businessmen.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Carl Malamud of the Internet Multicasting Service and Marshall Rose of Dover Beach Consulting. Together, they have recently proposed a scheme to enable people to send faxes worldwide for the price of an electronic mail message. My idea of the Internet is that people really weren't making money off of it.
Oh, well, you know, one of the myths of the Internet is that it's this free thing out here that the government paid for.
Yeah.
And that's not true. The government played an important role, mostly as a purchaser of services, not as a, gee, here's something in the public good, but mostly because it wanted to send messages to its contractors and to itself. But the vast majority of the Internet is, in fact, a commercial operation. And most of the places where you go buy your Internet service, you are paying money for it, and that service provider is making a profit. What we're seeing now is the next level up. We've got an infrastructure in place. It's a global, decentralized infrastructure with many different providers. We're now seeing information providers go on top of that. And so there are now magazines and online bookstores and fax servers.
Marshall, you wrote this software to bring this telephone and fax together and email together. Are you making any money from this?
No. In fact, Carl and I basically have put ourselves in a position kind of as a policy oversight, and as a part of that, neither of us have any financial interest in this project. We're just trying to make sure that there are certain policies of fairness and procedure which are followed with respect to that.
With luck, though, people will make a lot of money off this and maybe buy us dinner occasionally.
Is that what you're looking for?
You bet. Free dinner.
Only if it's a fine dinner, though.
I had to buy you a drink. Does that count?
You don't make enough.
I still owe you dinner. All
well,
right.
When you make more, I'll get dinner for
then
you.
Then you'll get dinner. Okay. Well, why are you doing it?
Well, I guess there are really kind of two reasons. One reason is the Internet is, in addition to being a production environment for millions of users, it's also a very good experimental test ground. And, you know, Carl's kind of outlined, you know, some of the policy issues and the digital deli. I like that phrase. That's, we got to service mark that or something. You know, he's used that kind of phrase. And I think one of the things which we have to do is kind of gain experience in offering new kinds of information services on top of the Internet infrastructure. The Internet has proven to be a very successful general-purpose platform for developing all of these things, and so this is just one of our experiments.
We hope to see the experiment continue. The goal here is to make every special-purpose device addressable on your general-purpose computer. And a fax machine is one example of one, but think about a TDD terminal. A telecommunications device for the deaf. It would be really nice if we could take the 20 million people on the Internet and allow them to send a message in to any TDD terminal. You think that would be a valuable service? It's very similar to the fax service, and there's no reason why other special-purpose devices, like telephones, can't be integrated into this general-purpose environment.
Basically, for the price of your access to Internet, you may send faxes everywhere. What are the projected cost savings?
Depends where you're faxing. If you're sending a fax to Australia, where we have service, if you're sending a fax to the Netherlands, where we have service, I would suspect your cost savings are fairly large. We know exactly. It's very simple. You call up your telephone company and say, what will a 3-minute call to Australia cost me? And it's in the dollars, okay? It depends on what time of day and which service you're using and all that, but it's dollars. Electronic mail is either fractions of pennies or pennies, depending on who your service provider is. And so we're looking at 100-fold more cost-effective service to the consumer. Now think about that for a second. The fax market in the United States is $9 billion a year. That's a lot of money. If we can save the American consumer $8 billion of that a year and invest the rest in a general-purpose infrastructure for our future, so instead of spending money on expendables, you know, telephone calls, we're actually investing in our information economy, I think that's a good thing.
So $9 billion is being spent a year on the telephones, calls, services associated with fax.
In the United States.
Alone.
Just in the U.S. And there are estimates that the amount of overseas traffic devoted to facsimile is anywhere from 50 to 70% of the total traffic, total revenues going out there to the telephone companies goes for facsimile service. Now, I want to make an important point, by the way, which is that we are not bypassing these long-distance services here. We think there are more cost-effective ways of using those services, and people like Marshall and I are the ultimate consumers of telecommunication services. We have very large phone bills. What we want to see is people beginning to use telecommunication services increasing by orders of magnitude. We think people don't use enough telephone service. Right now, your phone may be used a half hour a day making phone calls. We think your computer should be on the Internet 24 hours a day. If it's on the Internet, it's buying telecommunication services 24 hours a day. So ultimately, this is very much for the benefit of our telecommunications industry that we're doing this.
What do the telephone companies think of this scheme?
Well,
do we
it's
know?
An experiment. It's an experiment, and a lot of people have come up and asked us to describe the experiment. And we described the experiment, and there's a lot of kind of head-scratching and very interesting, and people are watching to see whether it'll work. It is an experiment.
Well, to interrupt, I remember someone asking, is it legal? Why would they ask such a thing?
Oh, maybe they didn't know. It is legal. It is perfectly legal. Certainly in the U.S., there's absolutely no doubt that this is legal. In other countries, we believe it is legal in almost all economies in the world. There are a couple potential hot spots that we're looking at and saying, you know, I personally wouldn't operate a remote printer server in Singapore, for example. I'm not sure if under the current telecommunications laws of that country, whether that would be legal or not. I don't know. I really don't.
So that every place you go in the world, they'll have to figure out, given their laws, what they can do?
Well, the motto of TPC.in is think globally, act locally. And that's really, we're looking at remote printer servers to spring up like mushrooms in all these countries, and they're going to have to deal with a lot of those issues. What is fair advertising, for example? You know, can you put nude women on the cover page of a fax? Well, maybe in Sweden you can. I don't think you can do that in Muncie.
I can assure you can't do that in Muncie. This project officially began in July. Where in the world is it now available?
In terms of international access, Australia, we expect to see New Zealand come online a little later this month or early next month. Amsterdam in the Netherlands. In the United States, we basically have saturated coverage of Silicon Valley, Washington, D.C., although at the moment it's just the 202 area code and it's getting larger. Just yesterday, a site came up basically providing access to all of Boston. We have coverage in New York City, kind of spotty coverage in some other little areas. You know, in some cases, a remote printer site will basically say, oh, I'll just do the whole area code. You know, it's no problem. And in other cases, well, I'll just kind of do my local calling area. So it's, you know, some places good, some places, you know, a little spotty. Certainly nowhere near the kind of the ubiquitous coverage we'd expect. But then again, we're only, you know, a couple of months into this.
Do I have any control if I'm sending a fax over what the ad is?
That's an interesting question. Right now you don't, but, you know, like I said, this is an experiment, and several people have raised that issue. For example, is it appropriate to be advertising the local junk food place in a fax going into a school? That's a real issue, and we don't know. The policy group is looking at that, and we're trying to figure out, really, how do we handle that? Ultimately,
We'll see.
Technically, you could have some control. We haven't structured it that way right now. I don't think we really want to because it makes it much more complicated, and simplicity is the key to success in these projects.
My guests today are Carl Malamud of Internet Multicasting Service and Marshall Rose of Dover Beach Consulting. Together, they have pioneered a new use for the Internet. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. You touched earlier on privacy. What information is available if you've sent this fax out, and what is being kept private?
Well, in terms of the privacy issues, an operator of a remote printer gateway basically is not allowed to examine the contents of the message you send. And there are very strict rules as to the amount of auditing information they can keep, and the purpose of the information is strictly for debugging purposes. So, for example, if you were to send a message and you didn't think that it had gotten through or something, you know, you could send the operator there a message and say, you know, on such and such a date, I did the following, what happened? Now, the system is completely automated in the sense that when it successfully faxes, it will return a response to you so that you have an acknowledgement. Or if you supplied a wrong phone number and it's a voice line or something, you'll get a message back saying, you know, there was no fax machine there, try a new number. But the typical information which is kept is the electronic mail address of the originator, because you need to be able to send back the acknowledgement, the phone number in case you have to debug any problems, usually the call duration, and then, you know, some obscure facsimile parameters which, you know, are associated with that line. So in terms of, like, useful information, unless one wanted to compile, like, mailing lists, which, as Carl mentioned, is explicitly forbidden, there really isn't, you know, anything there.
So it's a little like giving your packet to a messenger. I mean, once the messenger walks out the door, they're supposed to keep everything all tight, but I guess they could open it and look at it.
And, we, you know, we have some control on that. TPC.int is the domain that Marshall and I and some others all around the world are part of a group guiding that domain. And what happens when you send electronic mail is it hits the name server and it says, oh, TPC.int, the following phone number, send it to this computer in Australia. If you violate our rules, we don't list you in the namespace. Now, there's another important corollary to that, which is we've got our rules on advertising on this and that, and it's under this TPC.int subdomain, but there's no reason why you can't start your own phone company on the Internet. And that underscores the idea that this is a general purpose infrastructure. We've started TPC.int with one set of rules. There's no reason why you can't do the same thing.
What if there's a problem with all this, a complaint or some misuse? What happens? Does anybody have anyone to go to?
Yeah, there is a policy board which maintains a set of procedures and policies for the remote printer operators. And if in order to be listed in the namespace, which is this referral service that we're operating, you know, you have to agree to operate by that. And if there's a complaint, then there is a board of arbitration or conciliation, which basically you can make your complaint to, and there'll be a resolution. Thus far, the board hasn't received any complaints, but again, we're only 2 months into this. I'm sure something will come up in the future.
Are you to the complaint board?
Actually, there are five of us.
Yeah, there's five of us. There's Jeff Houston, who is manager of the Australian Academic Research Network. He's a very well-known figure in Australia. There's Professor Jun Murai, who is a leading professor in the Japanese Internet. He has done some very key research on networking protocols. And there's Rob Blackshiel, who founded the European Internet Users Group. And the five of us form the initial board. We do have in the bylaws a provision that this is a co-op of the operators. The operators can select the board. We could get booted out of office in a year. That's certainly a possibility. We did stack the deck a bit to say there's staggered terms so we don't lose control immediately, because we do want to see this actually work. But basically, it's up to the members to control it, and a member is defined as someone who is providing service within the TPC.int subdomain. If you're part of the telephone company, you can vote for your board.
How do people find out more about this?
Well, there's an electronic mail address you can send to. Now, hold on carefully. This is a typical internet address. It's TPC, as in the phone company, -FAQ, as in frequently asked questions, town.hall.org. So it's tpc-faq@town.hall.org. And that will bounce you back a description of how the service works and how you can use it.
I can tell you guys are pretty amused by this project. Why is it so amusing? Because you can use the network in this new way without having to talk to anybody? Or is it a David and Goliath thing? You found a way around using the phone? What's so amusing?
I think amusing for me is the fact that is the simplicity with which we're able to like integrate the email and facsimile worlds. I mean, normally if you were to talk about doing this, you could imagine, oh, we have these two special purpose networks and we're going to have to build special purpose devices and it's going to be a massive undertaking in terms of people, time, and equipment. And no, this is the internet. You know, I mean, we're really designed around ease of use and generally hooking things up. And so, you know, the fact that two people can get an idea and a couple of months later launch a global service really kind of explains why the philosophy behind the internet community as a whole is really a good thing. So I guess that's really kind of the amusing part for me.
And that's really what we're trying to show people is that, look, there's this general purpose world out there. And, you know, in the last year I've been able to start a radio station with the help of Marshall, start a telephone company, and, you know, who knows what else you can do. And that's why it's so essential. When you look at order of magnitude increases in productivity, and that's what we're looking at right here, it is essential that people begin to understand that that is out there. It needs to be used, and it's not going to be used in 20 years or 30 years or 50 years. It's there today.
So you're amused because you're the Ted Turner of the Internet.
Well, except I'm a Ted Turner, and I'm a real small Ted Turner, and hopefully there'll be lots of Ted Turners on the Internet.
Well, I look forward to meeting your Jane Fonda.
Oh, I do too.
Marshall, Carl, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
My guests today have been Carl Malamud of the Internet Multicasting Service and Marshall Rose of Dover Beach Consulting. They have proposed a scenario which enables you to send faxes worldwide over the Internet Global Computer Network. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. It seems like we grew up with mass marketing. Advertising on billboards, in magazines, and on television and radio has been designed to target whole communities of people. Don Peppers writes in his book, The One-to-One Future, about the new focus on marketing to the individual. I know I had thought that mass marketing was here to stay. I asked Don if this is a misconception.
Exactly. It's not permanent at all. In fact, it was very temporary, it turns out. Mass marketing grew up with mass production, assembly line technology. mass media, which works just like an assembly line. The same products go to the same people, the same messages go to this, to everybody. And mass distribution, which is the same as mass everything else. It's the same products in every store. But with increasing advances in information technology, you're finding that individual companies are not only producing individual products for particular customers, that is, tailored, customized products, but also very soon we'll be sending customized messages to individual customers, and they'll be talking back in two-way, interactive, addressable communications.
Much of your background has been in advertising. What are the characteristics of this one-to-one advertising media?
Well, let me give you a contrast example. In mass media, the bargain that the marketer makes with the customer is an implicit bargain. It's kind of an honor question. Watch our commercials, and the programming comes free.
Okay. Yeah.
Read our ads, and we'll subsidize the editorial content of your newspaper or magazine. But that, the reason the bargain is implicit is the marketer throws the messages out there. He's forced to by the technology. He cannot control who watches what and charge people differently for what they read or what they agree to see or not to see. But if that marketer were dealing in a one-to-one medium, that is a medium where individuals get individualized messages based on their interests or what they've said they want, he could, in fact, make an explicit bargain with the customer. Watch this 3-minute video on our new car and we'll subsidize the next pay-per-view movie, for instance. That kind of bargain. Now that may be a way to visualize it with today's technology, but imagine the video dial tone. What does that mean? The video dial tone means anyone with a telephone and a TV camera can become a TV broadcaster. You're going to have not 500 channels, but 500,000 channels. You have so many channels. You have as many channels as you have phone numbers, technically. The formats of one-to-one media are real time and your time. Anyone who takes electronic mail at work understands the meaning of real time and your time. A real time is a real time conversation or forum, maybe, and your time is a mailboxing and bulletin boarding operation where you post a message and someone gets it, or some people look it up, or you send something to somebody's mailbox. Well, that's the way television and other media are going to be delivered to individual consumers in real time and your time formats. So my Aunt Millie could take her Sony Handycam out to weddings, 8 or 10 weddings per weekend, and just film the weddings, okay? Secure some kind of permission slip from the people whose weddings she's filming, and then go to a service bureau, have those weddings on tape stored on someone's computer, and consumers will dial them up, maybe $1 a pop. Maybe just give us your name and address so we can give it to the caterer who can. So if you're planning on getting married, you can look up Victorian spring chartreuse with a fish motif or whatever you want.
Now, what do you mean precisely by one-to-one technologies?
One-to-one technologies work in a totally different dimension, a different direction from mass technologies. A mass competitor focuses on one product at a time and tries to sell that product to as many customers as he can find. A one-to-one competitor focuses on one customer at a time, one relationship at a time, and tries to sell as many products or services to that customer as he can over the lifetime of that customer's patronage. And one-to-one technologies are the technologies both in information processing, you know, computer power, and in communications technology that are necessary to empower that competitor to do the relationship. And it sounds high tech, but it really boils down to a very high touch. Let me just give you 3 stories. You stay at a Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta today and order room service, order white wine, and ask for an ice cube in it. Then 2 months from now or 2 years from now, stay at the Ritz-Carlton in Naples, Florida, or Cancun or San Francisco and order white wine. From room service, it'll probably come with an ice cube. Okay. Now, that is kind of a outer limits idea, but most people find that a very high-touch scenario.
Well,
let me give you another story, though. Even small businesses can do this. Last year, a friend of ours sent flowers to his mother for her birthday in a small Midwest town, called the florist, ordered the flowers. This year, 3 weeks before his mother's birthday, the florist sends him a note. Mom's birthday's coming up. Last year we sent freesias and spider lilies. What would you like to do this year? I mean, that's a very friendly way to market.
This is really true. I have to say, unfortunately, it didn't involve the Ritz-Carlton, but I ordered a pizza. I have two young sons, so they eat a lot of pizza. And I called up, and they said, well, give me your phone number, and I did. And they said, well, the last time you ordered, they told me exactly what I had ordered. And I was like, ooh,
whoa.
This is just a little pizza joint.
But the thing is, pretty soon you could just call the pizza place up and say, I have the usual. My name is Myra Gunn. Give me the usual. You know, and they'll do it. And the thing is, all businesses used to be that way, because the deli owner in the 1800s really was a one-to-one marketer. He kept his database in his head. He had, 50 or maybe 75 customers, and it wasn't hard. But today's supermarket owner or a mass marketer needs computers. And with the advent of computers, we're going back to a very, very high-touch, one-on-one relationship. Let me tell you one more story.
Okay.
One more story. Because this is really one of my favorite stories. You know how difficult it is to buy a swimming suit, especially if you're a woman.
Are you talking to me?
Yeah.
Men have trouble buying
God.
Swimming suits, but women, it's a disaster. I've never,
don't know.
Oh.
You don't know, Don.
It's awful.
Okay.
Well, last year, my wife and I were in Rhode Island, in Newport, and we went into a swimming suit store, and this is a customized swimsuit store. And the way it works is my wife goes to the back room, stands on a platform, and tries on a swimming suit that sort of fits, and has her picture taken front
this
on.
This is not going well.
And then in profile by a digital camera.
Absolutely not.
By a digital camera. We go to the front of the store, and on the computer screen, we adjust the fit of her swimming suit. A little higher down here, a little lower there. How's that? It's a little asymmetrical here. How about this? You want a different material? We pick from 200 different materials. When we get just the right fit and just the right look for the swimming suit, one piece or two piece, we order it. And 2 weeks later, it comes totally customized to the house. Now, the punchline of the story is, my wife never has to go fit for a swimming suit again. This swimming suit store has my wife's prescription for swimming suits. So as awful as it is, going out shopping for a swimming suit, and really that's a paradigm for almost any shopping, because people don't really like to shop a lot when they're, some people like to window shop, but this is a way that the store has, using information technology, has kept a record of the customer's individual needs. And the price of the suit was about 5% more than off the rack.
What I'm hearing is that in the mass market era that sounds like we're coming close to the end of, there would be statistics about the trends of populations. What in general do people want to watch? Is that a good match? If we're going to put our commercial here with the Saturday morning cartoons versus with Law and Order at 10 o'clock on a Wednesday night. So you were trying to basically shoot the trees, send out a bunch of stuff, and hopefully there'll be some identification with that product or what they're seeing, how they feel, or the feeling from it. Now we're talking about technologies that allow us suddenly to get down to the individual.
That's exactly right. And the dynamics are totally different. Mass marketing is based on sampling and projection research. I take a sample of the population, and I conclude that a certain portion of them want my product. I take a sample of the media audience, and I conclude that a portion of them saw and were persuaded by my commercial or my advertisement. Even niche marketing is based on sampling and projection. No matter how small the niche is, fundamentally, almost all marketing today is sampling and projection-based marketing. Now, you can get very, very tiny niches. There are, after all, twice as many products in the average supermarket today as there were less than a decade ago. I mean, it really is no surprise anybody goes out in a supermarket. But so the supermarket today can carry 30,000 products, but could it carry 60,000? Could it carry 600,000? I don't think so. What's happening really is that marketers are beginning to tailor individual products for individual customers. And to do this is a collaborative process. The marketer, the company, first has to get the customer to open up. Tell us about yourself. Tell us what you want. Tell us exactly what you want. Let us get your prescription, and then we'll make the product or service.
For effective marketing, a certain amount of confidential information must be gleaned and retained by the selling organization. What about privacy?
The privacy issue is really, really an important issue, and it's more important in an age of interactivity than it has ever been before. Imagine you come home, kick off your shoes, you turn on the TV set, and you see a Chevy commercial. And you use the remote control device to push the Tell Me More button because you're thinking about buying a car. So you look at the lease terms and you look at how the Chevy looks on the underside and maybe you look at a different model. But you're not going to buy a car right now, so you keep going and you watch the program. And then that evening you're sitting down to dinner and the phone rings and it's the local Chevy dealer wanting to know if you've made a decision yet and if he can help you.
That's irritating.
That would be extremely irritating. That might be the very last time you would interact with your television set at all, at least with a commercial use. So what's going on here is that it's very possible that if the structure of the interactivity, the media system, isn't set up to set a buffer between the consumer and the marketer, that both consumer and marketer will find it very unappealing in a very short time. On the other hand, if I could interact with the commercial and have the fact that I interacted with the commercial conveyed to the marketer, but without my name and address or phone number, without any way that the marketer could reach me except through the television set, then the next time I see a Chevy commercial, they could pick up where I left off, okay? And I haven't yet revealed myself. I haven't held my hand up and said, okay, send me an offer. It's sort of like mystery shopping. Going into shopping anonymously, the sales clerk doesn't come over to you until you say, okay, I'm done browsing, now I want to get serious. I mean, that's the future of interactivity.
Let's talk about specifically some of the new one-on-one technologies coming down the line. Give us some examples there.
Do you know how many coupons are disseminated in this country every year?
No, haven't the slightest idea.
Billions and billions. 320 billion last year. And only about 2.5% of them are redeemed. And most experts estimate that somewhere between 20 and 40% of redemptions are in error or fraudulent. There's a lot of fraud goes on. Why? Because coupons are disseminated in freestanding inserts in a Sunday newspaper, big piles of colored coupons, and you clip them out and you take them to the grocery store and they barcode scan them and they give you the 20 cents off or the 85 cents back or the 2-for-1. Marketers could, in fact, that what they'd really like to do is they'd like to send different coupons to different households. And they could, in fact, do that with today's technology. One of the ways they could do that, we explore in the book, and we call it couponing by phone, using 900 numbers in reverse. Instead of you paying us for the information, we pay you when you make a phone call. Okay? The way it would work is this. Suppose you're Kellogg, you put an individual proof of purchase number in every box of cereal. Consumer goes to the store, buys a box of cereal, comes home, opens it up. Inside is this proof of purchase number. He calls 1-900-KELLOGG, uses his touch tone to punch in the proof of purchase number, and his phone bill gets credited to $1.50.
Ooh.
Or this is the first time he's redeemed that any coupon for that product, so we'll credit you $5 the first time you have the first box on us. That's addressable couponing. This is the third time you've redeemed coupons for Kellogg's cereals. Have you tried Eggo frozen waffles? Here's an extra offer. I mean, once the consumer gets on the line with the marketer, the computer could take over today and begin running the relationship. And that's one of the ideas we have.
What about fax response? What is that?
Fax response is a big idea. The fax machine really is a way to talk to computers, and there are all sorts of companies going into business this way right now. If you take Mac Warehouse, the catalog for Macintosh users, it's an ordinary catalog, but every item has a paragraph and a picture of it, and then at the end of each paragraph is a fax box number. You turn to the back of the catalog, and you go to your fax machine, or anybody's fax machine, dial that number, punch in the fax box number, and then push the start key, hang up the handset, and on your phone call you paid for, out comes 2 or 3 or 15 pages of specifications on this fairly complex product. Now think of what pharmaceutical companies could do with this, with their detail men visiting doctor's offices, you know, constantly trying to update the specifications on drugs. We're talking with a number of different companies. Martha and I, my co-author, Dr. Martha Rogers, and I are talking with a number of different companies in the business of disseminating information about doing just that. There are companies out there that make a market for jewelry prices, for instance, or for artwork using fax response. And nobody stands at Mac Warehouse's end feeding that paper in. And, you know, your fax machine is talking to their computer.
So it's sort of a combination of when you call up and you punch these numbers and responses and saying push 2 for this kind of number and 3 for this, you go through that with the handset on your fax machine, and when you hit the information you want, you press start, and then it comes back at you.
Right. In fact, we have a fax response page in our book. At the end of the book, you can call a number. It's in Chicago. It's not a toll-free number. And you pay for the call. You go to a fax machine, call that number, and by punching in a box number, you can look at 2 or 3 pages summary of any one of 10 or 15 Doubleday currency books coming up that are all sort of headlined in the book, at the back of the book. And this is a way that the publisher can preview these books in print and upcoming to readers of our book, The One-to-One Future. And you know what we paid for this service?
No, I don't. What did you pay?
Well, it's a secret in the book. We put it in the notes page, but I'll let you your listeners in on it. The entire service for a year costs under $5,000. It costs $400 a month. We rented it from a service bureau.
So that a small business could go in and for $400 a month, they could create a fax response nationally.
And could handle thousands of replies a month if they wanted to. That's what we anticipate.
This is Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Don Peppers. With Martha Rogers, he is author of the book, The One-to-One Future, Building Relationships One Customer at a Time. How are organizations changing given these new approaches and these new technologies?
Well, and they're changing. Organizations are changing in every area, and there is a whole movement of re-engineering involved, which really involves a lot of downsizing because information technology is making a lot of middle management jobs obsolete. So one mega trend that's going on is that thousands, hundreds of thousands of white-collar workers are being let go, more or less permanently. I don't think U.S. West is ever going to hire back the 9,000 people they let go the other day, and IBM isn't going to hire back the 40,000 they let go last year. These people, however, are not being let go in the same way that factory workers in the Rust Belt were let go. It's, you know, if you were a blue-collar worker or a factory worker and your plant shut down, I mean, what were your recourses? You collected your union benefits and your unemployment benefits, and then they either opened a new plant or you had to leave town, go somewhere. If you're an information worker in middle management and you're computer skilled, they let you go. They give you 5 or 6 months severance, sometimes 12 months. They give you a year's worth of medical. You set up your own business. You get a laptop and a fax machine. You can set your own business up. So thousands of these people are setting up business. In fact, the percentage of the workforce employed by the Fortune 500 has gone down by over 30% just in the last few years. But the number of households that are that report some kind of income-producing activity at home is over 25%. There's 26, 27 million households right now who report, according to one researcher, report some kind of income-producing activity at home. So that's a mega trend. There is another trend also, and that is the competitor who wants to control customers, to manage customers, okay, to improve their lifetime values to him of their relationships over time, has to organize differently than a company that is managing products. A mass marketer selling one product at a time to as many customers as you can find has product managers and brand managers, and they are in charge of awareness levels and, you know, distribution, penetration, that kind of thing. A one-to-one marketer, a one-to-one competitor, needs to have managers of customers, customer managers. And we think we're seeing a lot of organizations beginning to group their customers into what we call portfolios of customers. A portfolio of customers is like a portfolio of any other asset. The assets being managed are the customer's lifetime values, as calculated by the marketer's computer.
So the idea is not to break down by products, but to break down by who, in fact, you're selling it to.
Right. So that somebody, right now, there's somebody at Kellogg's who's in charge of Frosted Flakes, and that person can probably tell you their share of market in my town last quarter, and maybe even by inference among teenagers in my town last quarter. But they can't, no one at Kellogg or Procter & Gamble or anywhere else can tell what their share of my breakfast is. They don't know. And they're going to be finding out in the not-too-distant future, because this interactive technology is going to empower them to talk to individuals. And customized cereal is just around the corner.
You've been talking about getting customers for life. Has there been a shift from the short-term gains to more long-term success?
That's hard to tell, and certainly it's not very evident within companies reporting financial results and so forth. I think that it will occur. I think what's happening as you shift to managing customers as opposed to managing products is that the managers within your company will be rewarded for long-term gains as opposed to short-term gains. A lifetime value is a long-term asset. And if I'm the customer manager in charge of retired empty nesters on the East Coast with my particular travel product, and my company's computer says that the lifetime values under my management are $20 million total, and during this year that value goes up from $20 million to $25 million, all that value may not be realized this year, but the computer is projecting that it would be realized over the next few years. That's a short-term event, that change in lifetime values, on a long-term quantity, the lifetime value itself. And so my stewardship of the customer portfolio is going to be judged more and more on long-term benefits. So, yeah, I think you'll see a shift to long-term.
When the store you're shopping at is on your home computer, what will work and what isn't going to work?
Stores exist for two reasons. The first reason is they are physical inventories of places to put products, and people come and get products, physical locations. The second reason is they exist to exchange information. You go into, say, a grocery store, and you see the price and quantity information on the products, and you tell the clerk what you want to buy by taking the product off the shelf and putting it in your shopping basket. As information technology empowers people to manipulate information and to exchange it in communications more handily, the information exchange function that we do now in the store won't necessarily have to take place in the store, or it might be greatly expedited. Let me give you an example. You run a furniture store. A good customer comes in, is trying to imagine what her furniture looks like, this couch is going to look like in her living room. You could, in fact, buy a digital camera from Kodak, a disc kind of camera, for under $200 retail, lend the customer, your best customer, this camera, tell her, go home, take pictures of the room where you want to put the couch in it from different angles. In fact, take pictures of all the rooms in your house with furniture in it and bring the camera back in, and we'll put your living room up on our computer screen and we'll show you what our couch looks like over by the fireplace. Or you want these end tables a little too high for you? How about these? They're a little lower. So we now have your prescription for furniture, and we're helping you exchange information with us. We're helping you imagine, which is the information exchange that takes place in the furniture store. But there are all sorts of examples of this.
So it's fine if you're isolated on your home computer, if it's something you can really understand and work with and just see. But once you start getting a little more complex, then you've got to have a store. You just interact with it differently.
Well, most people still don't have personal computers. The penetration of personal computers is very small, and those with modems is much smaller. And interactive television isn't here yet. But imagine a future 5-6 years from now when the bulk of urban households do have interactive television, and you can imagine an interactive household furniture channel where I use a digital camera and I send you my disc. And then on my household furniture channel, I look at furniture that's in my living room and my dining room, my bedroom. Okay, I can imagine that, and I'd shop at home. When I get ready for a new sofa, I take a look at what's available, and you're going to have furniture custom made anyway. Let me give you another example of how stores will do things. Take the ATM machine. You know, as recently as 1980, there were very few ATM machines around. In fact, people were still predicting the demise of the ATM because no one wants to really use a machine. And now, of course, there are many of us would rather deal with an ATM than a clerk. But ATMs are very underused. In many states, ATMs appear in grocery stores. some states they don't, but in many states you can have you can find an ATM right in a grocery store. Well, why can't I go to my ATM machine and call up recipes? Okay, put my cash card in, I go to the recipe screen, and I use the touch screen on the ATM to call up Mexican recipes or Indian recipes. So I see a recipe for chicken curry, right? I call up the ingredients, I get them printed out on the same sort of receipt printer that I print my withdrawal slips on, and I go into the store. Now, a smart bank would have that tied into the grocery store so that along with the recipe, I get some coupons for the particular ingredients that are in the recipe. I get some kind of tracking device that goes to the cash register so the people at the grocery store find out that I actually used it. The smarter bank, when I put my cash card in to begin with, it'll say, "Welcome, Mr. Peppers. Did you enjoy the chicken curry that we gave you last time? Did you eat it? Was it too spicy? Was it not spicy enough? Would you like chicken curry salad? And would you like a different nationality?" I mean, that kind of leading question and customization of relationship is what is the future of the store.
What do you mean by informationalizing products?
A product is informationalized. Informationalization is incidentally, it's a word from Stan Davis's book, 2020 Vision. And it means really taking information from the customer or the user of the product and injecting information like that into the product itself. So, for instance, the customized bikini example that we talked about, customized swimsuit, is a swimsuit that's manufactured according to information gathered directly from the customer. The flower delivery service is a reminder service for your mother's birthday that's generated by the florist's information from the original birthday, for instance. Okay, Ritz-Carlton service is informationalized. So that's what we're talking about with informationalizing.
When you talk about the potential success of a company, you don't look at their products so much as their ability to innovate. Why is that?
Largely because of the same trend in information technology. The time during which any innovator can collect monopoly rent for his innovation has shrunk. I was talking with somebody the other day who has consulted in the software business, and he said his client told him that they used to figure on about a 2-year window between bringing out a new piece of software for a personal computer and really having a good knockoff out there. And now they count on only about 60 days. What's happening is that this window, innovation window, is shrinking. So every product you have, every service you have, you got to figure is going to get knocked off by an imitator, a competitor, within a very short time, which means that the only thing of value is not a patent. It's not a copyright. It's the idea to have more ideas. It's the ability to have more ideas. That's creativity is what has value now. And that's accelerating the rate of change in all business.
In the end, you say, all your products are ephemeral. Only your customers are real.
That's the last line in the book. And some people think that's the most effective line of the whole book. And it's true. In the end, the only thing that has value for you is a customer. Your product can be knocked off. Your service can be knocked off. The value of a customer to you is the value of his future purchases, the margin on future purchases from that customer, minus the cost of maintaining a relationship with him. So if you are a true one-to-one marketer and you're using a share of customer philosophy, which is what one-to-one marketing is all about, and you're tracking your customers and predicting their future transactions with you, then you're in a position to be able to assess the value of your company in terms of its customers.
Don, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Marta.
My guest today has been Don Peppers. He is author of the book, The One-to-One Future, a currency book published by Doubleday. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for TechNation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.